Hello and welcome to this week's Big Boat interview with me, Sophia Wilson. This week's interview is a special episode as part of Boat's Ocean Talks event supported by the Ocean Family Foundation. Timed to coincide with World Ocean Day, the three-day digital event aims to highlight the plight of the world's oceans and those fighting to save them. With that in mind, I'm delighted to say that this week's interview is with the legendary explorer, marine biologist and ocean advocate, Dr. Sylvia Earle. Having been given the moniker, Her Deepness, Dr. Earle is the former chief scientist of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and is the National Geographic's explorer in residence. In 2008, Dr. Earle also went on to found Mission Blue, creating hope spots around the world. She spoke to me about the importance of acting now to save not only the future of our oceans, but also the future of humanity, and how she believes the yachting fraternity can be at the forefront of this movement. I hope you enjoy the interview. Sylvia, thank you so much for joining us today to be this week's Big Boat interview as part of Boat's Ocean Talks Week. It is such a privilege to have you be part of it. Given your incredible career, I didn't really know where to start, but I thought maybe we should start right at the beginning. What first fascinated you about the ocean?
Well, the ocean got my attention when I was 3 years old, when a wave knocked me over. But what really captured my love of the ocean is the fact that it's filled with life of such immense abundance and variety, so many creatures that occur only in the sea and nowhere else on the planet.
And can you still remember the first time that you went diving or even just snorkeling when you first kind of realized that there was all that life there?
My first time breathing air underwater was not with scuba. It was with a copper diving helmet. It was in a river in Florida. But even there's so much life. And I thought I was going to go down to observe the fish, but what really struck me was the fish came swimming right over to look at me. That was just such a stunning experience. I mean, you walk in a forest and the birds don't fly down to look at you. Well, sometimes they do, but very rarely. Usually they fly in the other direction. But the curiosity of creatures in the ocean, it's just such innocence. Well, that's true, except where they've been fished or where they've come to fear humans. But this is in the 1950s, and personal encounters between people and fish underwater were still pretty rare.
And was it that moment that you then kind of decided to dedicate the rest of your life to exploring that part of the world, or how did it go from there?
I mean, kids are naturally curious about everything. they're true explorers. When I'm asked, how did you become a scientist? How did you become an explorer? I say, well, it was really easy. You start out as a kid, everybody does, and you start asking questions. You know, who, what, why, where, when, how, why not? Questions that everyone should continue to ask. And I certainly have never stopped. And I think that's what drew me into the ocean, wanting to know everything I could about it. And I'm still doing that.
Do you still feel that same exhilaration when you go underwater today?
Of course. You know, you never know what you're going to see, who is out there, and what are they doing? It's never the same. It's always exhilarating.
And what have been some of the biggest challenges that you've faced kind of over your career, particularly as a woman working in a scientific field?
There are limitations about exploring the ocean, whether you're old or young, tall or short, no matter what gender. Technology is finally enabling us to get below where you can go holding your breath or even using scuba. I'm now doing whatever I can to promote the development and use of submersibles that have the capacity to wrap a safe environment around us, air-breathing creatures, to be able to take ourselves safely into depths of the ocean. I'm working right now with the company that my daughter and son-in-law actually own and operate, to go to at least 1,000 meters with little submersibles that can take three people and so simple to drive that even a scientist can do it. But with a trained operator and two passengers, but anybody can take the controls and actually fly underwater. With the new technologies that now exist that keep developing, systems, little submersibles called Deep Hope, that are versatile, that you can add not just sophisticated lighting and camera equipment, but the kinds of instrumentation that continue to change, that scientists and others might wish to add for to custom outfit this platform to be able to go to. It's still not to even the average depth of the ocean. That's about 4,000 meters, the maximum 11,000 meters. Technologies do now exist to be able to go to full ocean depth, but the number of individuals who have been to the deepest parts of the ocean, I mean, so many more people have been to the top of Mount Everest, for example. A dozen people have been to the moon, and just over a dozen have been to the deepest part of the ocean. Consider how many people there are who have been 11 kilometers high in the sky. You know, literally hundreds of millions of people now have flown that high above the Earth, but just over a dozen have been that deep in the ocean. So we're right at the edge of the greatest era of exploration ever. And it should be exciting to kids, to you, to anyone, about how we now are for the first time able to not just look up, but look down into the great diversity and abundance of life that share this planet with us.
Do you find it strange that obviously there's so much kind of noise at the moment about space and space tourism and everything else, that all of that exists, but as you say, so few people have even explored what's there waiting to be explored on our own planet?
Well, it's not just about the exhilaration of exploring and discovery. It's the lack of understanding the ocean that causes us to be complacent about it. It's only fairly recently that climate scientists have seriously taken into account the nature of the ocean and how it truly governs climate and weather, that it shapes planetary temperature and planetary chemistry. Take away the ocean, we don't even have a climate. And most of life on Earth exists there. We've neglected ocean policy, ocean care, because we basically have been largely ignorant of its nature and why it matters. With every breath we take, every drop of water we drink, we are truly dependent on the ocean, connected to the ocean. And because of really not understanding the nature of the ocean and how it really governs our existence, we have used it as a dump site, putting whatever we don't want close to where we are on the land into the sea. And we've also used the ocean, curiously, as a source of free groceries we take, thinking that it's, historically at least, infinite in its capacity to yield whatever we want to take, whether it's whales or shrimp or lobsters, certainly fish, and not even recognizing them as individuals, measuring them as products by the ton. We still measure fish and shrimp and set quotas for life in the ocean about what we want to extract by the ton. And it's the attitude that we once had about birds, thinking of them as just free for the taking, and large-scale extraction of wildlife from the land has led to extinction on a grand scale. We've begun to appreciate that there are limits to what we can take from the skies and from other creatures from the land, but we're still extravagantly taking from the ocean far more than the ocean can yield and still have things such as tuna and cod and swordfish to take.
Do you think people's perceptions are changing? Do you think people are becoming more aware of the role that the ocean plays in our survival?
I think since the middle of the 20th century, we have learned more at the same time that we have lost more. And right about now, early in the 21st century, yes, you're right, there is a greater awareness. But we have to really hurry, because although learning and knowledge and communication is scaling up, so is the loss. We're down to 10% of the sharks from where they were, even in the 1980s. We're really good at finding, catching, marketing ocean wildlife. And we're beginning to get really good at connecting the dots, of understanding the value of what is now being referred to as blue carbon, carbon that is contained in ocean life. Just as it's taken us a while to realize the value of trees and other terrestrial life, and to assign a value beyond just the value of trees as board feet of lumber or ground up for even for energy, or burning wood as a source of energy. We're actually consuming so much wildlife out of the ocean, blue carbon in the sea, that the impact on climate, the carbon cycle, we're now beginning to calculate. The International Monetary Fund conducted a study that was released at the World Economic Forum in 2020 about the carbon value of living whales. $1 trillion in carbon of the whales that, if kept in the ocean, not just the carbon sequestration value, capture and sequestration value of whales, but the fact that they give nutrients back to power the phytoplankton and the mangroves and seagrasses and other carbon capturing sources, photosynthesis, that we understand it with trees, or at least it's been on the balance sheet for longer than understanding the forests of the sea and their importance in, through photosynthesis, of capturing carbon, turning it into food, into sugar, that then becomes the basis of the great ocean food chains, but also the basis of the carbon cycle and the oxygen cycle. Oh, by the way, where does oxygen in the air come from? It's restored every day. As we draw it down, and life generally takes oxygen out of the atmosphere, burning fossil fuels takes oxygen out of the atmosphere. Burning forests, it extracts oxygen from the atmosphere. You know, combustion and burning energy requires use of oxygen from... Anyway, that's the chemistry of the planet is something that has been developing over the history of Earth. And humans, through our actions, especially in recent times, have unwittingly disrupted some of the basic cycles of what scientists refer to as planetary biogeochemistry, that we have made a place for ourselves on Earth by displacing so many other forms of life. And now we're beginning to understand the importance of finding a sustained place for ourselves within the natural systems that make Earth habitable, that make our existence possible. Until right about now, that the capacity to understand how the planet works, what we've been doing inadvertently to foster our prosperity, how that has affected the natural processes, the natural planetary chemistry. And I think we're the luckiest humans ever to come along because we can see and understand what was not known and could not be understood until now. Certainly not when I was a child. No one had seen Earth from space. Even the smartest people who ever lived before our ability to fly high in the sky, dive deep into the ocean, to know how the planet functions, to know about the connections between all forms of life, the biogeochemistry of the planet, how it connects to rocks and water, if you will. But it's the living planet that maintains our existence, not just the geological and chemical history. It's the biological connections that make our existence possible.
And prior to talking today, I went back and listened to the TED Talk which you gave. I think it was back in 2009. And then you were kind of talking about all this font of information that we had available and that, you know, like you've just said, we're in such a privileged position to understand the situation that we're dealing with. Do you think we've done enough with that in the past? It's now more than a decade has passed since then.
Well, knowledge is scaling up, but so is the need to know, because the impact we are having on our life support system, if you will, planetary processes that make our existence possible, we are continuing to put into the atmosphere carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide that are driving a swift increase in temperature. We're destabilizing the natural systems, both on the land and now increasingly in the ocean, with consequences that are not working in our favor. What is becoming clear is that we must protect the natural living world as if our existence depends on it, because now we know it does. Our existence does depend on maintaining healthy air, water, and the fabric of life that make Earth exceptional in a universe that is really hostile to our existence. I mean, people are dreaming and doing whatever is now technically possible to gain not just access to Mars and other places in the universe, where perhaps someday we can set up outposts of humankind, but here on Earth, we have everything going for us. We've got a natural built-in life support system that it's the best chance we will ever have for maintaining civilization and all the things that we care about, our history, music, art, our culture. We don't have to start from scratch. We already have our foundation right here, opportunity to extend our reach into the universe beyond really depends on making peace with our home planet. And we are not doing everything that we should be doing or can be doing. First, people have to really understand that it's our highest priority. We have to keep the planet safe for our existence. We have to protect the water. We have to protect the atmosphere. We have to work with nature to not destroy the very systems that keep us alive. We've developed habits born of a time when we thought that the ocean was infinite in its capacity to take whatever we wanted to put into the ocean without any problems. And now we can see there are problems. We have to change our ways about what we put into the ocean, including carbon dioxide that is causing not just warming for the planet, but acidification of the ocean, changing the ocean's basic chemistry. And there are consequences that we now have to deal with. In addition to planetary warming, the acidification of the ocean is setting in motion other changes. It just, we're looking at those creatures that have a calcium carbonate shell, like oysters and clams and other mollusks, but the backbones of fish, the just so many things that when you trigger one thing, chain reactions extend throughout the entire system. We've done this already. Now, knowing what we've done, there's a chance we can change our behavior to try to stabilize the problems that we've created. Imagine if we did not know that burning fossil fuels is generating excess carbon dioxide that is driving accelerated planetary warming on top of the natural global, slow, gradual processes. We are accelerating changes that do not work in our favor. What can we do now? That's our challenge, to see how we can modify our current behavior, reduce the amount of CO2 that's being generated, and methane and nitrous oxide into the atmosphere, and to protect the natural systems that safeguard Earth as a habitable planet in a universe that looks beautiful, but it's really not very friendly. I mean, setting up an outpost on Mars is really not easy. Even getting to Mars is a very big deal, even for a few people, let alone the idea that we could transport large numbers of humans as an alternative place for our civilization. Our civilization, our history is here. Our future is basically here, whatever future we'll have. Understanding that is cause for hope. If we didn't know, we would continue doing the things that have gotten us into this very difficult place. But now we know, and actions are within our grasp. Climate scientists say this decade, the next 10 years, between now, well, not even a decade, between now and 2030, the best chance we will ever have to stabilize planetary processes, climate, the water cycle, the oxygen cycle, the fabric of life, to maintain stability that works in our favor. I think we should all be excited about the chance we have to be the point in time, be part of the actions that will enable us to have a long and enduring future. The decisions we make now, the actions we take now, have a magnified impact on whatever happens in the future.
And what should we be doing on a kind of individual basis? Because sometimes it can seem overwhelming and it can seem like everything needs to happen on such a huge scale. But what should we all be doing as individuals that can be make that change?
Clearly, no one can do everything that needs to be done to reverse the decline, the planetary decline that now faces us. But everyone can do something. It's taken all preceding history of humankind with individual decisions that have gotten us to where we are. No one individual has created the warming of the planet. No one individual has stripped the ocean of life. It's taken billions, over millions of years. Well, we have like only about 10 years working together, armed with knowledge, the superpower of knowing that our decisions individually and collectively can shift decline to recovery and stability. If everyone looks at the ocean of problems that are out there, the small decisions we make every day about what to eat or not, what to wear or not, how to travel or not, what are you doing that takes a bite out of the planet? What can you do to influence those around you so that the individual actions become magnified by 1, 10, 100, 1,000, a million people taking the right decisions, moving in the right direction? to understand that what we're taking out of the ocean, what we're taking from the land, our destruction of nature, has individually and collectively an impact. I'm excited about the move that individuals are making about choosing to eat lower on the food chain, that a more plant-based diet has a lighter carbon footprint. You say, well, I'm just one person. So consuming meat three times a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you got to have meat on the menu. Or you can say, I'm going to cut back. Even if you don't go to totally plant-based, although imagine if we did, what a huge impact that would have on the carbon footprint that we are that we have on the planet. But even if you change in a modest way, and it does matter, times 10, times 100, times 1,000, if everybody said, I understand that the consumption of beef has a huge impact on the emission of methane and carbon dioxide, and I will make a personal choice to cut back. Doesn't even require that you stop. Although if you did, it would have a bigger impact. So, you know, it's understanding the problem so you can be part of the solution. And we are really destabilizing the ocean through what we're taking out. The ocean wildlife is in serious trouble. The food chains, the carbon cycle, the oxygen cycle, the chemistry of the ocean is impacted by what we are taking out. Hundreds of millions of tons have been removed just in my lifetime. And every year, it's like on the order of more than 100 million tons extracted from the ocean. And the carbon capturing mechanisms destroyed in the process. When you think, what are fish worth? What are whales worth alive in terms of the carbon cycle? And knowing that it's a problem that we are disrupting the cycles through our consumption of ocean wildlife, when we have plenty of other choices about what to eat, food security is a looming issue. But we're not going to solve it by eating tons of ocean wildlife. We're going to solve the food crisis by better food distribution, by better food choices, by going increasingly plant-based, and by recognizing the impact that we're having with agriculture, and have better farming practices, as well as what we're taking from the wild. It's time to really look in the mirror and say, on one hand, here are the problems, and on the other, what can I personally do, and what can I do through my power to influence others? Whether you are a kid, or a CEO, or a teacher, I don't know, anything, everybody has power. In fact, we all have superpower because unlike our predecessors, we know what the problems are. And we know what the solutions are. The biggest problem is just being motivated to do something and not to get discouraged because the problem seems so large.
And you spoke recently at the Monaco Yacht Club. How do you hope that the yachting community could be involved in protecting the world's oceans? And what are some of the things you'd like to see them really get involved with?
Beyond what most people can do, the yachting community, those who, first of all, love the sea and know something about it, have seen firsthand why the ocean matters to everyone, everywhere, all the time, an enhanced capability, the superpower of knowing and the ability to influence others, both by example and by encouraging others to look at what we now are able to do because we know what the problems are. Use of sail to power vessels across the ocean used to be not only commonplace, it was the only way to go. And taking advantage of harnessing the wind, both as a means of powering across the ocean, but also to assist in motor sailing. The power assist is an idea that seems to be catching on in the transportation generally, even for large ships that are how most goods are being transported, looking at engineering ways to complement using sunlight and fossil fuels as a means to get goods from one place to another. We have to think differently and understand that our consumption of fossil fuels must change. It's not just more efficiency to look at alternative energy sources, and it's happening. The other ways that those who love going to sea in ships, in boats, wherever we go into and around and on the ocean, look at the efficiency, the engineering capability that now is within our grasp. I love the ways that those who love the sea and love going there in yachts are really addressing how to have a lighter touch. And it may start with just the joy of being on the sea and more efficiently and going faster in the ocean than we've been able to before through engineering skills. But it translates then to other uses of the ocean, the transport, the shipping, that 50 years ago, it didn't seem necessary to be fuel efficient because fuel was relatively inexpensive. And the importance of what we're putting into the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels was not as widely appreciated or understood, how that could negatively impact the world. So now we know. And I think the yachting community in many ways is leading the way toward a lighter touch about how more efficient use of energy is having unintended favorable consequences on the way we interact with the ocean. But more than that, those who go to sea are witnesses, not just what they see from the surface, but understanding basically what's under the boats, what's in the ocean. Getting to places that most people don't get to see, polar regions, the ability to access the world beyond. Of course, we can do it by air, but going by sea really impresses those who have the capacity to sail, to go beyond your home ports, if you will. You're witnesses to change. You engage with other people, other cultures, and you see that we all share a common planet and that we have to take care of it. It's extending into the ocean, and it's maybe just in time. Currently, only about 3% of the ocean is safeguarded specifically to protect life in the ocean. The fish, the kelp forests, the coral reefs. 97% of the ocean is open for business, if you will, for extraction, for oil, for gas, for minerals, for fish, for whatever people take from the ocean for use. And there have been consequences to this open access to the sea. It's the freedom of the seas, not just the freedom to gain access on the surface, but to take from what's beneath the surface to foster our desires, our wants, as well as our needs. And now we can see it for the first time. And I think the boating community generally can see more clearly than most because you're out there. You've witnessed, even if you've only been out there on the ocean for a few years, you see what most people do not, and understand the magnitude of the problems in ways that most people do not. So it not only gives you the superpower of knowing, but it gives you perhaps an enhanced opportunity to do something about it. If you don't know what the problems are, you can't do anything. But once you know, you can't unknow. It's there. You can see it. And so I urge the boating community to really be leaders in terms of ocean understanding and ocean care.
And the work, you've obviously created Mission Blue as part of the work that you're doing to both raise awareness but also create these hope spots around the world. What's the kind of idea behind that, and what do you hope that can be achieved through it?
About 10 years ago, I started Mission Blue, an organization that is aimed at trying to give back to the ocean, give back to nature, hope spots, to work with individuals, with communities, with countries, with anyone and everyone, to give hope to the ocean, to use whatever power you have to safeguard the sea. Right now, a network of 140 hope spots exist around the world to connect people and their power, their understanding, their actions, and with more than 200 partner organizations and countries around the world and companies to use their power directed toward safeguarding nature. The focus for Mission Blue is primarily the ocean, but it's all one blue planet, land and sea together. So what is done by our partners to safeguard and increase protection for the land affects the ocean. What we do for the ocean affects the land. It all does come together. And by focusing on places, it is an obvious, tangible way to begin. You can invest in safeguarding and restoring health to a place. But they're also overarching actions, like what we eat, what comes out of the ocean, wherever it comes from. And what we do that puts carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide into the atmosphere. It affects everything, everywhere. The place that is affected is Earth, all of it, and it all connects. And the good things that happen anywhere resound and reverberate everywhere, and the bad things too. So this is such an exciting time when you think about, now we know what the problems are. We know what the solutions are. So why wait for someone to tell you what to do? Just look in the mirror and figure it out and go for it.
And in your head, do you think 2030 is that kind of cutoff point where after that we've gone too far?
Well, there are many actions that, I mean, we can see tipping points all around us, that when a species gets down to a level where every year more die than are born, you get to that point where extinction is inevitable. It's happened when passenger pigeons are no longer with us, that there's a mass extinction currently underway. It's thought that even though we are not aware of many species that have gone extinct through our actions, our deliberate actions, the use of pesticides, herbicides has literally wiped out already thousands of species. And the recent study that is rather alarming, that by the end of the century, if we do not change right now, we may lose as much as half of the known species, as well as many that we've not even discovered them yet. They're in the ocean in particular, that is the least known part of our planet. New species are being discovered all the time, at the same time that unidentified species are being destroyed when coral reefs are destroyed through fishing techniques that just eliminate them. The use of explosives to kill fish, for example, it seems like a very convenient thing to get a lot of fish very quickly, but then the reef that generates the fish is eliminated, and many species that are endemic, that live only there, are destroyed in the process. And the conversion of coastal coral reefs, when we convert coastal areas to create more land, they call it reclamation, whatever was there, of course, is destroyed. And while a lot of species are widespread in their distribution, many are not, that they are homebodies. They only occur in a specific area. When we convert a salt marsh or a seagrass meadow or mangroves or the nearshore areas, whatever they are, into land, we lose the life that was there, that is part of the network of life that makes Earth function in our favor. I mean, in my lifetime, since I began exploring the ocean, I've witnessed the loss. Again, looking at sharks declining by 90%, bluefin tuna in the Pacific is down to about 3% of what was there in the 1970s. You know, species after species that we know about are already collapsing through our actions, through our appetite for ocean wildlife on our plates, or used as products in various ways. Fish oil, krill oil. You know, we can go straight to the plants to get the oils that we desire for our food or for supplements or for whatever purposes, rather than looking at taking fish as the source of oil or krill or squid. We can see it and understand it and therefore change and do what is needed to restore stability. Imagine that of the almost 2 million species that inhabit the planet that we know about, that by the end of this century, that half of them could be gone. Suppose you look at the ship, the yacht, the boat that you're on, and you just arbitrarily kind of take away half of the elements of whatever it is, you know, that makes the boat operate, or an airplane. Just eliminate half of the parts, or half your heart, gone. That's what we're aiming for right now if we continue depleting the fabric of life that holds the planet steady, that makes our existence possible. So knowing is the key. If you know that insects really matter, we will avoid using the wholesale application of insecticides that kill indiscriminately. They're biocides. They kill the targeted species like mosquitoes and other things that we consider to be pesky creatures, but we eliminate all of those that are along with them that are vital to pollination, that are vital to the basic planetary processes that have taken, you know, all preceding history to get into place. And think of what we have done already. We must think differently about how we behave toward nature. It's only hope that we have for looking at the future in a positive way.
And is that the one thing you'd like people to take away from listening to this interview, that we must think differently?
Think differently and act differently. Use your power.
Well, thank you. I think that's a positive and important message for us all to end on. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been such a privilege to hear your thoughts and to hear you speak.
Thank you for having me on board.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's special edition of the Big Boat Interview. For further coverage, articles and insights from Ocean Talks, visit the Boat International website and keep an eye out on our social media channels. This week's edition was, of course, mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen. Please don't forget to like and subscribe, and we will be back next week with our usual schedule.